From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Here's how it works on TV. Take your typical Law & Order episode. A woman is sexually assaulted. She's examined in the hospital. Swabs and DNA samples from a rape kit get sent to a lab. Then there's a match, an arrest, and justice prevails. But in real life, hundreds of thousands of those rape kits never get tested. Many U.S. cities are trying to confront that backlog. They're trying to get those kits tested and hopefully get results. But that's created a brand new problem. What should officials do with those results, especially when some victims of decades-old cases have rebuilt their lives and may not want the renewed trauma of looking back? This hour on Point, confronting the rape kit backlog. And you can join us on air or online. Is this your story? Would you want the results of your decades-old rape kit? Are you a law enforcement officer who's had to inform victims? What is the best way for cities and states to deal with the backlog of rape kits? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today is Jessica Contrera. She's features writer at The Washington Post, and she recently wrote the article, Decades Worth of Rape Kits Are Finally Being Tested. No one can agree on what to do next. And we've got excerpts of that article at our website, onpointradio.org. Jessica, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. I mean, first, if we can, let's just start with the basics here. When we talk about rape kits, I mean, what exactly are we talking about? These are the tests and the samples that are taken from a woman after she's been assaulted?
Yes. So, and if an individual reports a rape to the police department or goes to a hospital and says that they have been raped, you know, pretty much the first recommendation is go get a kit. And what that means is that a person, most often a woman, goes to a special kind of nurse and goes through an examination that can take hours. And what that person does is sort of swab and take the necessary things off of their body. It can be quite invasive and difficult, takes photos, things like that, so that if there is evidence of, you know, DNA from another person on that woman's body, that it can be collected and potentially used as evidence later on.
So then those samples are handed to a law enforcement officer.
So it kind of depends on the state, you know, what the chain of command is. But, you know, typically the idea is you put all of the samples in a box, you seal the box so that you know it, no one's tampering with it, and then the box goes to a lab. And then the lab knows what to do to take each piece of you know, each swab, each photograph, look for what needs to be looked for to see is there, you know, DNA from another person in that box.
But the presumption is then if it goes to a lab, that they should get tested.
Correct. So, you know, many women who go and get this test, you know, it's just as you, if you went to get a test at the doctor, you would assume that it would be tested. But and the reality is that up until, you know, just last year, there were no national standards for what should be done with these kits. So what you had was a very haphazard system where some jurisdictions, some states, they tested all their kits. Some left it up to the individual detective to decide whether that evidence, you know, would potentially help or not. You know, it's not always the case that these kits lead to convictions.
So Jessica, just for clarity's sake, when you say there were no national standards, does that mean that the procedures could vary not just even from state to state, but from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, city and town within states?
That's correct. And, you know, it could even depend on, you know, what time you go and report your crime and who's on duty and who gets who becomes responsible for your case. If that detective decides that your kit might not be useful, then they might not send your kit. Or you had many states where, of course, they were under-resourced, underfunded, and they were not only not sending kits, they weren't even investigating these cases to the proper extent.
Right. I want to play a little bit of tape here because this is so widespread. I mean, for example, in Tennessee, today there are still 9,000 untested rape kits in Tennessee. And we have some tape here. This, you'll hear the voice of Jane. She's a rape survivor from Memphis. And she told CBS Evening News, she told Jerika Duncan at CBS, that the kit from her rape, from Jane's rape, in 1990 remained untested in December 2016.
you have fingerprints and DNA available to catch someone and you don't test a kit, I would say they didn't try to catch him.
Police records show the last time a detective worked on the case was 2 weeks after the rape.
Whatever road that I was on that night was taken away. It's made me scared of the dark.
That's Jane, a rape survivor from Tennessee. Jessica Contreras, I mean, respond to that, because it would seem that as even if in cases where perhaps a lab doesn't have enough staff to test all these things, that decades going by and kids still seem laying there untested just seems astonishing.
It really is, and you see it all across the country. You know, different states, different cities have different size backlogs, but pretty much, you know, wherever you look, you're finding these kits stacked on shelves, you know, not being touched.
Mm. Well, I want to play one more piece of tape here about why that might be. This is actually from Albuquerque, New Mexico. We're actually going to hear from the mayor of Albuquerque in a little bit, because the mayor there asked local police departments to explain why they had a backlog. And Albuquerque's chief administrative officer, Sarita Nair, told NBC that in some cases, it's because police questioned the victim's credibility.
For about 20% of the kits, we found, unfortunately, that it was sort of a symptom of not believing the victim. Words like witness didn't cooperate, witness didn't follow up, those things are really coded language for we didn't want to test the kit because we didn't believe the victim.
Well, that's from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And joining us now is the mayor of Albuquerque, Mayor Tim Keller. He has signed an executive order in January that requires law enforcement to develop a plan to process the city's backlog of untested rape kits. Mayor Keller, welcome to the program. Let me just first start by asking you, how many untested rape kits are in Albuquerque?
Well, at last count, there's about 3,900. And unfortunately, that number continues to go up.
It continues to go up. Okay. Mm-hmm. Why? I mean, we heard that piece of tape there from the city's chief administrative officer that said about 20% of the untested kits are there because law enforcement didn't believe the credibility of the victim herself. What are some of the other reasons why you have such a huge backlog?
Well, we have 30 years worth of backlog, and a lot of the cases, too, I think a quarter of the cases even have to do with minors. So the situation is, it's deplorable here. However, what they've identified is that we do have a mechanical resource issue as well. So we've been able to estimate how long it takes to test a kit, how many technicians you need, and so forth to go through the system. And so it's going to cost about $6 million to actually process the backlog. And unfortunately, for 30 years, no one has prioritized $6 million to get this done.
Does the city have the money now?
Well, I just took over as mayor in December, and so we are going to prioritize getting those done. And that was the executive order that we put out. When we looked at this, I was, interestingly, the state auditor. And so we did an audit of these untested kits, and it was the first one in the state. And so we're able, hopefully, to actually, you know, act on the problem that we found, you know, in a previous role. But it is going to take doing things like putting money towards ending the rape kit backlog instead of to new parks and stop signs and things like that. And that's the kind of trade-off that just wasn't happening in the past.
Hmm. Now, I understand that you've given law enforcement officials in the city a two-month timeline to come up with a plan to tackle the backlog.
Yes, and we first identified the plan or the issue almost 2 years ago, and we have two laboratories in New Mexico that deal with this, and we saw the state lab basically come up with a plan in 9 months to end their backlog, and then we saw the city continue to let their backlog increase, and that's why we're using a very strong measure to say we are going to get this done, and that's why we gave them 2 months to come up with a plan to figure out how to do it.
Yeah, and so, but you signed this executive order back in January, right?
Yeah.
So we're at that 2 month deadline.
Well, in 2 weeks.
And okay, so what kind of? I mean, can you tell us what kind of progress has been made so far then?
Well, actually, just because it's not due yet, we know a couple of things. We know that they've identified the cost and the resource needs. And we've also identified, and this did start under the previous administration, a way to farm out some of the testing to other laboratories. But you can't always do that. There's lots of strict evidence rules. But we have been able to process 300 kits since we got into office. And so we know we have sort of effective pilot programs. And in a couple of weeks, we expect to have a roadmap to get all of them done eventually.
Okay, so here's the question. And this question was laid bare in Jessica Contreras' reporting, and she's still here listening in. When you start, you know, tackling that backlog, some of the cases may be decades old, right? I mean, what are you going to do with the results? Because there's a big issue about how you're going to inform victims that suddenly, maybe after 20, 30 years, there's some new information about their case.
Well, there is, and cities like Detroit and Cleveland have been through this, and there is a whole other challenge around notification and even processing of the legal cases. And what we've found in our audit and our research is you really have to develop a broad process, but also treat each case uniquely because each case is unique. And so it's a time-consuming process, but it's a process that should have been done for decades. Mm. So we're not going to let that hold us back, but hopefully it also leads to some sort of closure for the victims. Hopefully it also means getting some of the perpetrators off the street, because we've seen about a 10 to 20% hit rate when it comes to finding perpetrators who are still at large in other states.
Right. Mayor Keller, stand by here for just a minute. You're hearing the voice of Mayor Tim Keller. He's mayor of Albuquerque, New Mexico. We're also joined this hour by Jessica Contreras. She's a feature writer at The Washington Post, and she's been reporting on the fact that there are decades worth of untested rape kits out there. New question of what you do with the results when they come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hey, this is Stretch Armstrong.
And this is Bobbito Garcia, the hosts of What's Good.
We're back with a brand new season.
We've got Erykah Badu, Lenny Kravitz, Black Thought, and more.
You'll hear B-side stories from A-list guests. Subscribe now.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the shocking backlog of rape kits, hundreds of thousands nationwide that never get tested, sometimes for decades, and the new movement amongst cities to get those kits tested, which presents a brand new challenge of what to do with the results when they come back. We're joined today by Mayor Tim Keller. He's the mayor of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and in January, he signed an executive order requiring police there to develop a plan to process the city's backlog of untested rape kits. We're also joined by Jessica Contreras. She's a features writer at The Washington Post. She's written the article called Decades Worth of Rape Kits Are Finally Being Tested and No One Can Agree on What to Do Next. Fascinating article. We've got an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Mayor Keller and Jessica, hang on for just a second. I'm going to come back to both of you, but there are a lot of people with stories to tell about this, so let's just hear at least from some of them. Andrea is calling from Pierre, South Dakota. You're on the air.
Hi, Meghna.
Hi. What's your thought today?
Well, I was raped about 5 years ago, and I went right to the hospital afterwards. They performed the rape kit, which is, as has been mentioned, is very invasive. You know, they go in, they scrape for DNA samples and whatnot, and, you know, even the nurses were like, oh my gosh, this is horrible, blah, 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 blah. So they had all of this evidence right there. And when they went to arrest the suspect, none of that evidence made any difference at all. The story that he told and the other people in the house told didn't match up to my story or the physical evidence that the rape kit provided, and so they dismissed the case entirely.
And so are you saying that part of you isn't sure about what good it would do to test this backlog if it's not going to be used effectively as evidence later on?
Exactly. You know, like having all of these, you know, this evidence doesn't do any good if it doesn't get used to, you know, get these people off of the streets.
Okay.
You know, after I went to the cops, after I did all of the things that you're supposed to do, you know, I told, I used my voice, I said the things you're supposed to say, and none of it worked. Mm. None of it helped. I ended up seeing the guy again out in public, and it was terrifying to know that he was still out there. And, yeah. You know, I mean, is anything going to come of testing these? Are we going to hunt down all of these people that performed these terrible acts, or, you know, what's going to happen?
Andrea, I'm sorry, forgive me for interrupting you, but I want to turn your question to Mayor Tim Keller, because this is exactly an issue, Mayor Keller, that you're going to face once you start getting the results from this backlog. So what's your response to Andrea?
Well, I appreciate you sharing your experience, Andrea, and it's, I think, unfortunately, a sad reflection of some of the challenges in the criminal justice system. You know, as both of a state auditor who looked at this issue and now as a mayor, we are trying to own everything that we control to deal with the issue. And that's one, the one you articulated, has to do often with district attorney's offices. It has to do with the court system. And so it's, you know, I think it would be disingenuous for me to give you some sort of silver bullet, because I think that speaks to a lot of difficult issues in the system. But what I want to make sure we can get to, at least in our town, is that every kit is tested, because you never know what might actually occur. In other words, if the perpetrator in this case had raped other women, that DNA upload would have hit the CODIS database, which mm-hmm. is a national database, and then the case would have been much stronger, because folks would have said, you know, this person has been, you know, has evidence pending in three other states. That's really where justice can be swift. And those, they call them CODIS hits is the term. That is, even if it's 10%, even if it's one, whenever there's a CODIS hit, there is usually justice.
Well, that's Mayor Tim Keller. He's mayor of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mayor Keller, it's been a great pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jessica Contreras, let me turn back to you here, because you've done some very deep reporting on this. From New York City, 17,000 untested kits. Houston, 6,000. Detroit, LA, Memphis, 11,000 each. There are so many cities across the country that are grappling with this right now. You focused particularly on something that's happening in Virginia, where a state law mandated that in dealing with this rape kit backlog, when results came back, that every victim needed to be informed of that. Now, on the surface, that seems to be exactly the right thing to do, but it didn't quite work out. What went wrong?
Right. So when you have all these kits coming back, just as you know, the caller mentioned, just because a kit you know, has evidence in it, that doesn't mean that the police and the prosecutors can take this case and go out and catch that person. You know, a rape kit is not a magic ingredient to a conviction. And so, you know, there's a question. You know, you have all these kits back. Who do you notify? Should you call every single person or notify every single person who had a kit tested and say, we want to let you know, you know, we weren't doing this before. Now we're doing it. You have a right to know. Some people say, absolutely, you should contact every single one of them.
Well, but in fact, in Virginia, right, the law, you quote a section of it, mm-hmm. this 2017 law, stated that victims or next of kin of a deceased victim shall be notified by law enforcement agency of the completion of the analysis and shall, upon request, receive information from the agency regarding the results of any analysis.
Right. When you hear that, to a lot of people, that sounds like that means every single victim, regardless of whether their kit, you know, had a hit, as the mayor mentioned, or if it was actionable, they could take it to court. But it turned out when I did this reporting that even though the police were under the impression that this law meant that they had to contact every victim, the people who created the law, that's not what they intended. They only certainly meant that, you know, those who had a hit, as the mayor mentioned, should be notified. And there was this total misunderstanding that nobody realized until I started asking these questions.
Well, so I'm going to come back to that in just a second. But you also spent some time with law enforcement officers who were charged with informing victims, right?
Yes.
Once their rape kits were returned, the results were returned. It did not go anywhere near as people had sort of optimistically planned. I mean, tell us the story. I mean, Lieutenant Harris is someone that you spent some time with. And like, what was the responses the lieutenant was getting when he picked up the phone and said, ma'am, we have results from your 25-year-old case? How did people respond to that?
Yeah, it really varied. I mean, some people seemed grateful for the information, but they also had women who, even though they were calling to say, you know, we got your kit back, and we looked at this case file, and we could see that the detective really didn't do his job before. And if you want to reopen this case, we're here for you. You know, they had victims who said, absolutely not. You know, why are you calling me? Leave me alone. And it's now, you know, in their training to say, okay, if that's what they want, that's what we're going to do.
Leave them alone because they had moved on? That turning, looking back on that moment in their lives would cause too much trauma? I mean, leave them alone. Why?
Yeah, I think exactly what you're talking about. I mean, you have a group of, you know, in this case, all women, many of whom, you know, they didn't get the justice that they had sought. They you know, moved on in other ways. The woman that I was referring to said, you know, I got married, you know, I've been remarried. My new husband doesn't know about this. You know, they don't want to reopen up those wounds. And that is the concern with notifying every victim. If you're notifying a victim, their case can't move forward. Some people argue there's absolutely no point in calling them up and saying, hey, remember this thing that happened to you 20 years ago. Yeah. We just wanted to let you know we're sorry, we still can't do anything about it.
On the other hand, though, you spoke to law enforcement officers, say, or law enforcement officers in Louisville, right, who want to mm-hmm. identify, who want to inform all victims, saying, you know, it's their information, it belonged to them to start with, that law enforcement has the obligation to follow up.
Absolutely. The lieutenant in Louisville told me that there was a case that they decided to know, you know, they notified all victims, and they notified this victim thinking there was absolutely no way. He said you could have lined up 10 detectives and they all would have told you there's no way a prosecutor's ever going to take this case. Then when they notified the victim, they went to see her in person. She offered up more information and they were able to, you know, arrest someone, or excuse me, they were able to indict someone based on her new information that she shared that they would not have gotten had they not notified her.
Let's take a couple more calls here. Grace is calling from Atlanta. You're on the air, Grace.
Hi, Meghna. Okay, I'm a victim twice over. Once a child victim and a string of child assaults by the perpetrator who got off in a court of law, a standing room court of law. 7 years later, I received a call from my family saying that they got the guy and he was in jail. It carries a great deal of shame when, like Andrea was saying, you do the process and they get off. I had 122 internal lacerations. I was a virgin and I was a straight A student. So it's like almost inconceivable. But The phone call I received from my family saying they got the guy gave me a great deal of personal peace, inner peace, and though I wasn't completely vindicated publicly. And actually, I wish they were trying to spare me at that time because it was only 7 years from the time. It was mm-hmm. still very fresh to me. I would have liked to have shown up in court and been the string of victims. I want to have
Grace, I'm so sorry to interrupt here. Your cell phone line seems to be breaking up on us. Let me just try one more time. So you said that this awful thing happened to you twice. I mean, did you get results
yes.
from the second time?
The second time, the second time, no results. I was just a victim that went into the hospital with torn clothes and beaten. Alone. I got myself to the hospital alone. And they did the rape kit. And that's been 15 years ago. I don't want to go. I do not want my life. I do not want my life interrupted. I do want the phone call if it shows up in CODIS. I do want to be on the list, but I would like for them to create perhaps a less interruptive solution, such as just, will you sign this paperwork? Will you look at the pictures and identify this is the assailant? Some of us can identify them. I would be able to, I think.
Grace, forgive me for jumping in on you here, but first of all, thank you so much for sharing your story. And second of all, I just want to take what you said and turn it back to Jessica Contrera, because she's done reporting about exactly sort of the different ways that that law enforcement officials may contact victims. So, Grace, thank you so much for your call. I mean, Jessica, did you hear what Grace said about perhaps less invasive ways of informing victims? I mean, in Virginia Beach, you were talking about how you reported how they ultimately decided to write letters.
Right. So that was a big question. You know, there's this number one question, who do you notify? And then the second question, how do you notify them? So, yes, it is more personal to go and do it in person. So some people argue for that. But, you know, we had advocates I saw in Virginia Beach who said, are you really going to, you know, have a police car or even, you know, an unmarked car pull up in front of somebody's house and go to their front door? Well, I mean, what if, you know, people asked, what if the person who was the suspect in the crime, you know, lived in that house? What if it was an issue of domestic violence that you could be potentially putting someone at risk? Then people said, well, how about we do a phone call? Well, some people said, what if the phone is shared by two people? Mm-hmm. And people said, okay, well, send a letter. And they said, well, that seems impersonal. So it didn't really, you know, there's a lot of disagreement about what's the best way to do it. In Virginia Beach, what they decided to do was to send a letter that said something along the lines of that, you know, you reported a crime on this day. We have, you know, completed an analysis related to that crime. If you would like more information, here's the victim advocate who you call.
Yeah. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Let's take another quick call here. Chandler is calling from Savannah, Georgia. You're on the air, Chandler.
Hi, Magna. I come from a law enforcement family, and I am also in law enforcement as well. And even though it is harsh for these victims to get some of that brought up in their life, oftentimes decades after the fact, and many of them have moved on, from a law enforcement perspective, it is very helpful for convicting these perpetrators who oftentimes are what we would call serial rapists. They don't often just rape one person, but it's a pattern that continues throughout their lifetime. And a lot of times in order to convict these people, the more instances that they are seen and can be filed under that CODIS system, mm-hmm. more times that they have times where they're put in that system, the better it is for a trial.
Right. Chandler, thank you so much for your call. Jessica Contrera, respond to that. I mean, the CODIS system here factors is an important factor in terms of how and when to notify victims about their results.
Yeah, so this comes to the question of whether or not all of these kits should be tested. You know, there are thousands of these kits that haven't been and thousands of new ones coming in all the time. And so it's a huge pull on resources to test every single one. And the argument that a lot of people make for still doing so, even though, you know, it does take a lot of resources and a lot of time, is that, you know, when you upload, you know, some of this DNA, it might not have a hit right away. You know, the police department that I observed, when they first went about this, they had, out of their 344 kits, 49 CODIS matches. Then a few months later, that number was up to 50 because someone whose DNA was in that batch had been arrested or had some sort of run-in with law enforcement where their DNA was uploaded.
Well, what's even more interesting about that is that mm-hmm. of those 49, then 50 cases, 48 of them, the victim had already named the person who ended up being the CODIS match as the perpetrator.
That's right. I mean, that's one of the very difficult things about a lot of these cases, whether old or new. You know, very, very often the victim knows the suspect. They might have had a previous relationship. They might have been hanging out all evening. And that makes these things difficult to prove. I mean, the rape happens often behind closed doors, no witnesses, and that's why this issue, often becomes so complicated, where it's just because you have a kit come back doesn't mean you can take it over to court.
Well, we are talking about the national backlog of rape kits and what cities and law enforcement officers should do when they start getting results back from some of these kits that are decades old. You've been hearing from Jessica Contrera, features writer at The Washington Post. She's been covering this issue. We'll hear from a victim's advocate when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
So you just woke up and you want to find out about the latest news. That is when you turn to Up First, the 10-minute news podcast from NPR News. Here, Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the enormous national backlog of rape kits. And as cities and towns try to do something about that backlog, they're presented with a new challenge about what to do with the results of these rape kits, especially since some of the cases, some of the sexual assaults that those rape kits deal with may be decades old. You've been hearing this hour from Jessica Contrera, features writer at The Washington Post, who's reported extensively on this issue. I'd also not like now to bring into the conversation Angelica Wind. She is executive director of Our Voice, a rape crisis and prevention center in Asheville, North Carolina. Angelica, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. It's a pleasure being here.
So, I mean, I think I come back repeatedly to this question. It's the one that's central to Jessica's reporting, and that is, it's good. It's a good thing that cities are trying to do something about this egregious backlog of kits. But in the cases of victims who suffered these horrible events that happened perhaps decades ago, how is it best to inform them, especially when you can never truly know in advance what a victim desires?
That's a great question. That's actually the million-dollar question. One of the things that what we do know is working with survivors is that the response isn't and should never be a one-size-fits-all solution. And having said that, one of the things that we would actually advocate would be contacting the survivors prior to getting their kits tested to see if they even want their kits tested, especially in the instances where years have gone by. When we talk about sexual violence, it's a crime about power and control. And often, unfortunately, when we talk about working with the judicial system, that there is room for growth, especially on the interactions with survivors. Survivors often report feeling disempowered, almost as they're not part of the process. And being able to allow that survivor voice into how we choose to proceed with notification is important.
Uh-huh. Jessica Contrera, is anyone that you spoke to in your reporting or any jurisdictions, were they thinking that way?
That's a really interesting idea. I actually hadn't heard that before. I think state legislatures and cities are under a lot of pressure on this issue because it is one that has been around for some time that people are so outraged about. And to them, a lot of headlines that say, we're finally going to test these kits is a good thing. So I would be interested to hear if they were considering asking the victims permission beforehand before they sent the kits to the lab.
Well, this is interesting because just last year, August 2017, the Department of Justice did release the first ever national best practices recommendations for how to deal with these rape kits. And one of the recommendations was that jurisdictions should have a victim notification protocol to inform victims of the status of their cases, including the status of their rape kits. So, Angelica, does it seem as if we've been making progress on that front then?
As a nation, we may. In terms of North Carolina, we don't have a notification system. It is something that has been pushed in light of as a recommendation in light of our own report that has just come out with regards to the a little bit over 15,000 untested kits that are here. But in terms of best practices, when we're working with survivors of sexual violence, one of the key components, regardless of the practice, is to be able to incorporate survivor voices to it. And oftentimes in the work that we do, whether at the legislative level or other levels, is that oftentimes the survivor voice isn't at the table, and that nobody's ever asked survivors what do they want, how do they want to see it.
Yeah. Well, let's take a call here. Robin is calling from Jefferson, Ohio. You're on the air, Robin.
Hi, Magna. I got a quick one here from the last half hour. When were officers given the job or even the right to decide if a victim, especially a rape victim, is lying or believable?
It doesn't matter this from the last half hour, Robin. It's still a really vital question. Thank you so much. Jessica, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, every, you know, case that come that a detective interacts with, you know, no matter what kind of crime it is, that is a lot of what they're doing, right, is figuring out, you know, here's the line of events that the victim said happened. Here's what witnesses say. You know, do these things match up? And what they're learning more and more is that it's so important for them to be trauma informed, to understand that these victims have been through something horrible, and that their story might not make sense at first, or they might remember things a little bit later. And that doesn't mean that they're lying. It means that they've been through a horrible trauma and their brain is recuperating. The police department that I spent a lot of time observing had gone through many, many trainings on those issues, had focused on them for a long time, but they could still see, you know, in those old cases when they looked through the case files, you know, phrases like, yes, the victim did not cooperate, or that she didn't want to answer the questions, when likely it might not have been the case.
Right. So I'm looking back again at those DOJ recommendations for national best practices from last year, and training law enforcement officers for specialized skills in interviewing sexual assault victims is indeed one of their recommendations. So hopefully we're seeing more of that. Let's take another call. Rachel is calling from Racine, Wisconsin. You're on the air, Rachel.
Yeah. Hi, Magna. I'm a survivor of a serial rapist, and so this is important to me. My question is about the statute of limitations. So what if the statute of limitations has passed by the time they get these rape kits? Are they going to make exceptions for not processing the rape kits, or are they, you know, are survivors supposed to sue the city or the state for not processing the rape kits?
Right. Rachel, it's a good question. In fact, one that's come up several times online. J. Chris Henry wonders the exact same thing. What percentage of untested rape kits sit idle so long they pass the statute of limitations? And that's the true crime. And Helica, do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I know that each state varies in terms of their statute of limitations. In North Carolina, there isn't a statute of limitations with regards to rape and certain sex crimes.
I see. So that it can't ever in North Carolina pass the statute of limitations.
Right. And each state is different. It's a scary proposition that there are certainly some states where maybe their statute of limitations aren't quite as robust as North Carolina, and that they're, by the time that their kits get tested, that the statute of limitations may have run out by then. But in terms of North Carolina, that isn't an issue that we're seeing.
Yeah. Jessica Contreras, do you have thoughts on that?
I think this is a really important question. Virginia also does not have a statute of limitations, and what that allowed the police department in this case to do is when they called up victims and said, you know, your kit has been tested, they heard from people. No, as I mentioned, you know, some people said, I don't want anything to do with this. But what the detective was able to say was, that's okay. You can call me back in next week. You can call me back in 5 years. There is no statute of limitations here in Virginia. And so whenever you're ready to go through with this, if you ever are, we're here for you. Mm-hmm. And in states where there is a statute of limitations, they might not not have ever been able to offer that, you know, or they might not have been able to move forward with any of the cases in the first place.
Hmm. Natalie is calling from Wheelock, Vermont. You're on the air, Natalie.
Hi, Magda. My rape was in early 2000s, and it was a stranger rape. They didn't process my kit for almost 2 years. During those 2 years, he ended up being a serial rapist. He raped three women. One, the last woman that he raped, had died. And with all of that having been said, I cannot imagine in my wildest nightmares not having my kit tested. It gave me closure. I could put a period at the end of that and go on.
Wow. Natalie, thank you so much for sharing your story. But I'm taken by so much of what you said. 2 years, though? I mean, yeah. did they tell you why it took even that long?
They were in a backlog, and I'm listening to your show. I was so appalled by 2 years. But listening to your show now, I feel really lucky that it was 2 years, okay. You know, rather than a decade.
Right. Natalie, thank you so much for your call. Jessica Contreras, so Natalie just brings up something that I hadn't thought of before, that as cities are dealing with their backlog, which, as we heard earlier in the hour, could be in some places thousands of kits. Actually, the mayor told us, the Albuquerque mayor told us a little earlier, they still have new cases as well. So how are they handling this such that the new cases, sadly, that happened today don't end up being the next backlog for 10 years later?
Yeah, that's so important. And thank you so much, Natalie, for sharing that. One of the things that has helped is that the District Attorney of New York has made grants available, huge amounts of money for departments all across the country to test their kits. So in Virginia, the kits that are backlogged, that are going to a lab, are going to a private lab so that they are not, mucking up the system for those new kits. But still, Virginia going forward has said we are going to test all of our kits. But what I kept hearing from people was, but they didn't really allocate more resources, more people at our state lab to be able to handle every single kit being tested. And so, you know, I don't know yet how much that's affecting things, how much things are slowing down. But it's important to remember that if you're going to test all of the kits, that takes a lot of resources.
Let's go to Kira, who's calling from Dothan, Alabama. You're on the air, Kira.
Hi. Just wanted to make a comment that it's been about 15 years, or actually at that time 14 years, until my kit was actually tested. I was raped at 9 and didn't say anything until the year after that, and had everything tested because I was raped again by the same person. But again, nothing was really done until years later after I've pretty much forgiven this person, gotten over the trauma and things like that. Don't get me wrong, it's still hard day to day. But I mean, if you're not going to do anything at that point in time, what's the point of telling someone years later? Although I would say that it's better late than never. You'll never know how someone feels about that situation unless you ask them. Right. As my mother says, a closed mouth is never really fed unless you say you're hungry. So yeah. Tell these people, at least their results. Give them a chance to say, yes or no.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if they don't want to hear it later on. Just give them that chance, opportunity mm-hmm. to deal with it. You never know where they are in that point in their life.
Kira? Thank you so much for sharing your story and your great humanity about this issue. Thank you so much for your call. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Angelica, I mean, you heard Kira there saying she believes everyone has a chance to know, but in her case, she'd also forgiven her attacker and moved on and didn't really see any personal use for the information.
Mm-hmm. I definitely want to thank Kira and all the survivors who have called in. It's not easy, even after years after the trauma, to be able to speak about it. So I do want to uplift their voices and be able to amplify it. And one of the things that I've heard in Kira and all other callers is the piece of them wanting to be a part of the process and wanting to be able to have the ability to say yes or no. And one of the things that we find at Our Voice is when we work with survivors, we we have hear back from survivors who've had a case that has where they've gotten a forensic kit done and ended up with a charge and subsequent prosecution, that they felt that they despite the fact that there was a prosecution, that they felt that they didn't feel that the justice was done, and they thought that the prosecution was going to play a larger role in their healing than what it did. And so one of the things at Our Voice is that when we work with survivors is to really work with them of where they're at, but also work with them around the piece of a conviction. A charge is only a slither of the larger pie of healing.
Yeah.
And so we've had cases where survivors have wanted to go forward with the judicial system and ended up in a not guilty plea where they felt that they have justice was done because they felt that they were a part of the process. They felt that they were heard. And most importantly, they felt that they were believed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is a national campaign called Start By Believing, which is seeks to address that issue, to just that issue is the piece of being believed.
Yeah.
And you can believe a survivor and there not be enough evidence to end up to result in a charge or a conviction.
Right. Angelica, really forgive me for jumping in here. Yes. I'm looking at the clock and we're running down on time, so forgive me. Mm-hmm. But I Jessica Contrera and Angelica, I wanted to come back to one thing which actually several of our callers and folks online are kind of stuck at, and that is, how did we ever arrive at this place to begin with, that a backlog of critical evidence from violent crimes exists, right? I mean, Jessica, I guess this question is for you. Have we been historically somehow treating sexual assault crime differently than other crimes in terms of the forensic value of the evidence? I'm stuck there. How did we get here?
I think it really depends on where you look. I mean, you have jurisdictions like a Detroit or a Cleveland where, you know, they were not putting the resources towards the investigations. And you also have jurisdictions like the one in Virginia Beach that I spent time with where, you know, that's a fairly well-off community. They were certainly investigating these cases, but they were being told, you know, okay, well, if this victim and, you know, identifies the suspect and the suspect says, yeah, we had a relationship, but it was consensual, then they were being told the kit's not going to help.
Well,
don't
so
bother sending the kit.
I mean, is there room here for a discussion? I mean, we've got 30 seconds left, so maybe not a full mm-hmm. discussion at all, that officer discretion shouldn't even be part of this picture anymore.
I think that's what most advocates are searching for, saying, you know what, it's not up to an officer. We don't know what's going to happen later on. You better test the kit just for the betterment of everyone.
Well, people of good faith across the country are really trying to do something about this. Jessica Contrera, features writer at The Washington Post. We've got a link to her reporting about this issue of the backlog of rape kits across the country. That link is at onpointradio.org. Jessica, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Angelica Wind, executive director of Our Voice, a rape crisis and prevention center in Asheville, North Carolina. Angelica, thank you so very much for providing your expertise and insight.
Thank you so much.
You can always continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. If you haven't already done that, today's the day. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Thanks for listening. This is On Point.